Hi, okay. Hi, everybody. It's Monday. It's 1 o'clock. Pesach is over. I hope you all had a wonderful chag, which ended for us in Israel on Motzei Shabbat, and for the rest of you on last night. In any case, we're back to business, and it's actually more appropriate that we should discuss that we should be discussing. Pirkei Avot, for the simple reason that there is a very old tradition from the time of at least of the time of the Gaonim, in other words, from the you want to late ancient, early medieval period, that one reads or learns a chapter of the tractate Avot during the 6 week bridge between Pesach and Shavuot. It's a practice which transcends communities. It was responsible for the fact that this tractate, which actually has only five chapters, received a sixth sort of ersatz chapter afterwards, in order to be able to build this bridge. And then what happened was the practice developed that again, this is done on Saturday afternoon, Shabbat afternoon, because the days start getting longer, and that you continue studying Pirkei Avot through the summer. What's really striking is a difference of fundamentally different attitude towards the tractate, and towards the wisdom within, between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, between Mizrahi and Ashkenazi Jews. Up until the late Middle Ages, the general attitude among Sephardim and Mizrahi commentaries or commentators was that Tractate Avot is a very profound, well, it is very profound, but it's really for the intellectuals. It's really for the people who are more advanced, who can delve into its inner workings and inner messages. Whereas among Ashkenazim, the idea developed, and that's actually the more popular perception on all sides today, that Avot is actually a popular book. And it's very, very clear, if you take a look at the medieval commentaries especially, and take a look how they approach this tractate. You compare Maimonides, for example, to the tract to the commentary that's attributed to Rashi, or even to Rabbeinu Yonah, who, though he was himself a Sephardi, who's very much influenced by Ashkenazim, you see the difference between sort of like an advanced philosophical or mystical approach on the part of Mizrahi and Sephardi commentaries, and the more popular ethicist kind of moralist kind of attitude you find elsewhere. Okay, anyways, that's not the issue. We started a long time ago, so we are going, that's last summer, so we are going to actually continue where we were. And we were discussing the comment by Rabban Gamliel that Selech harav v'histalek ma'asafek v'al tarbe le'aser umadot. Get yourself a rabbi, get yourself a teacher, get yourself an authority, and that way you can avoid doubt. And do not tithe by estimation. We'll get to that later. And we've been talking before, up leading in the run up leading to Pesach, we've been talking about the question of doubt and religious doubt. And is it, what do you do with doubt? And how can one deal with doubt? And especially in our present time, which is skepticism incorporated. So what I would like to start discussing, and we will continue in Mitzvah next week, is really to address, to look head on the question of, are you allowed to speculate as to whether the truths of the Torah are really true? And are there limits to that? What do our sages say about that? And when I say sages, I don't mean just mean the rabbis and the Talmud. I mean scholars, subsequent scholars. What do you do with doubt? Does a doubt, by definition, destroy faith? In other words, if I have a doubt and I keep going, is that bad? Is that good? What should I do with my doubts? Should I reach any decisions from questions, or learn to live with questions? All of these are very serious. Many people have told me that I can't accept X, Y, and Z because I doubt this and I doubt that and I doubt the other thing. And it doesn't make any sense. How many times have you heard about anything Jewish? Oh, it makes no sense to me. Okay, well, what does that mean? What are the implications? What does it say about you? What does it say about the Torah? What does it say about Judaism? What does it say about Jewish history? All of these are very, 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 very weighty and very repercussive questions, because we all face them. It's interesting, in a long essay, which I will actually I'll put the link up both on my Facebook page as well as as well as on the Tel Aviv International Synagogue site. Already something on the order of 40 years ago or 50 years ago, the late Dr. Norman Lamb published a long essay, which later became the name of a book, called Faith and Doubt. And he laid, and in that article, he laid out a pathway to addressing doubt. I'm going to discuss the essay, I think, in greater depth next week, but I strongly recommend you to read it, because it, even if you don't like his answers, he frames the question in a way which I think is the healthiest and most constructive approach to the issue that I've yet encountered. Okay, so let's start. First question is Vistaleg Ma'asafek, run away from doubt. Now, clearly, when that phrase was meant to come after the first part of the Mishnah, in other words, find yourself a rabbi and avoid doubt. In other words, if you don't know what the answer to a halachic question is, find a rav. You'll get an answer. Yeah, and that way you can rely on somebody else. And we talked about the fact that in our generation, where in our world, where expertise is considered to be a bad thing. There's a book by a guy whose name I cannot remember right now, and I'm not going to go run in the other room to get it, called The Death of Expertise, in which, you know, we all think, oh, experts don't know anything. I can find out on Google all kinds of stuff, and therefore I don't need experts. So who needs rabbis? Rabbi Google, Professor Google, Dr. Google, and so on. But what you find on the Internet is information. You don't find the critical tools to be able to parse the information, decide what's right and what's wrong. In any event, so that's clearly the simplest explanation of the Mishnah. Get yourself a Rav. If you have a Shaila, ask them a question, and then you'll be finished. But on a deeper level, it would appear that doubt is something which one should avoid. Histalek ma'asafek, run away from a doubt. Lisalek safek would be also to throw it away. So is doubt a bad thing? Is it a good thing? When it comes to belief, for example, what would we say? What is superior? A person who has sort of pristine, simple, unquestioning belief in God and in Torah and in right and in wrong? Or would it be better for a person to open themselves out to question, expose themselves, take the risk, and see where that leads you? Because ultimately, the possibility would be that the person who has simple, pristine faith can't deal with questions, unless they can really be totally compartmentalized. But generally, they don't have to deal with it because doubt has a habit of gnawing away and eating away at one's resolve and at one's convictions. And there's, you know, what you say, not, what's the word that we use in English? Gnawing doubt. Gnawing doubt. What does gnawing doubt mean? Gnawing doubt means it eats away at your ability to function. So maybe it would be better to open oneself up to examining one's belief out of the conviction and out of the hope that you will come out stronger, because if you confront doubt straight on or head on, you'll be in a position to be able to better address questions that come your way. And in our society, questions like that come up all the time. People are fairly aggressive, especially about religious belief, especially if those religious beliefs don't jibe with the current value system, or the current senses of truth or lack of truth. Now, as it happens, this this question is very much a matter of dispute already among the rabbis and already among the medievals. It's hinted at in a midrash. I realize that I'm going way beyond my notes, and this is going to take longer than one week or 2 weeks. Okay, please bear with me. There is a famous difference of opinion between rabbis in the Talmud, in the Midrash, regarding two exchanges that are recorded in the Torah between Moses and God. But they're very repercussive in terms of broader issues. So what am I referring to? In the third chapter in Exodus, the Torah says that Moses saw there was a bush that was burning, but it wasn't consumed. So he was amazed by that, and he wanted to check it out. So he went up, and he saw that there was a bush burning, and it was not consumed. So at that point, God says, Moses, he says, who I am, I'm the God of your fathers. And Moses then hid his face because he was afraid to look at God, or afraid to look at this manifestation of God. Ki yarei mihabit elai Elokim. So there is a different, interesting and intriguing difference of opinion among the rabbis as to whether Moses behaved properly. Did he respond properly, or did he not respond properly? According to one opinion, Moses did the right thing. He saw that God was revealing himself to him. He realized his inadequacies and his limitations, and as a result, he hid his face. And in return for that, God rewarded Moses, that when Moses wanted to, when he received or he came to get the second set of tablets after the episode of the golden calf, and he asked to have God's, have a more intimate awareness of who God is and what God is, God allowed him a distant view of a series of insights into who God is and how he runs the world, as a reward for that, knowing in full awareness of the fact that only what would be revealed to him is only as much as he was able to see. That's one opinion. The other opinion says, or maintains, that Moses did not act properly. Moses had an opportunity to have an unmediated and unrestricted access to God's presence and to God in his full plenitude as much as possible, I assume. And he hit his face and he blew it. Here he had an opportunity and he absolutely blew it because he didn't think. He said, "I'm a nobody. I'm Gornished. I'm, you know, who am I?" And it was a really terrible thing that he did. And as a result, when later on, when he asked to know God more intimately, God says, "Lo yirani Adam b'chai." At the same time, in other words, it's the same. We're contrasting the same two episodes, but deriving opposite conclusions from it. And "Lo yirani Adam b'chai," God says, "You can't see me and live." Too bad, you know. And the Midrash says, "When I wanted to reveal myself to you, you didn't want. Now you want. I'm not interested." Behind these two approaches are the questions of intellectual and spiritual daring. Is it better to be into intellectual, spiritually daring, which would be the second opinion, or no, one should recognize that there were limits to where one could go? Now, the two don't necessarily contradict each other, but they do lead. They can and have usually led led into different directions. So, for example, there is among Ashkenazim in general, and among not a few medieval Spanish philosophers, there is a firm position, an absolutely unassailable position from their point of view, that one should not ask questions. Don't go where you can't go. It is better to have unassailed, unquestioning, pristine faith and not explore it. Or as one writer put it, one should be held by, instead of instead of holding beliefs, one should be held by one's beliefs. That's one of them. In fact, among the people that have that, in fact, maintain that position is Rabbi Judah Halevi in the Guzari. Which is a philosophical defense of Judaism, but he said, you know what, if you really don't need this, better not. Because you never know where you can go. If you're starting at the right place, so what can be bad? Maimonides is the polar opposite. He would go with the one who said that Moses did not do what he should have done. And in fact, in the Guide for the Perplexed, Maimonides says that it's really too bad that Moses blew it. Moses lost his missed his opportunity. According to this position, a demonstrated faith, a rationally based faith, a faith which is based on argument that you can really not only use to push away doubt, but rather also to engage questions that are put your way, is a far superior, far stronger religious attitude and religious posture than a person who is simply a simple believer. So those two positions really go all the way back to, as I said, to the Talmud, and they very much exist today. I think it's fair to say that these two positions, vis-a-vis exposing oneself to doubt and when exposing oneself to intellectual and cultural and cultural challenge, I think that it's fair to say that those two schools very much characterize the various approaches within Orthodoxy towards interaction between Judaism and the outside world. The classic Haredi position, which was at first enunciated by Rabbi Moses Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moses Schreiber, in the early 19th century, and has been until this day the default position, is that one is much better off blocking the world out, keeping it out as much as possible, living, being held by one's beliefs, living in a closed circumstances, and getting on with the purpose of life and service of God. And that's really what what is behind a lot of the anti-intellectualism, anti-modernism of the Haredi world. And you know, you really can't blame them, I think, when you consider the fact that modernity has from the beginning took such a heavy toll upon previously traditional Jews who did not have the tools to be able to handle the questions and the skepticism and more of the modern world. My argument is, and I was glad to see that Dallas and Joseph was watching for at least, I don't know if she's still here, but she was earlier, because she's very much involved in this, and I applaud her her activities. The truth of the matter is that, in my opinion, and I don't think I'm the only one who thinks this way, the avoidance of doubt and the avoidance of modernity are no longer possible, even for Haredim. And that's one of the reasons why Haredi society is in a deep axiological and valued and epistemological crisis in many, many places. Not everywhere, but in many places. What do I mean? It used to be that one could actually live one's life isolated from the rest of the world. You could have your own papers, and you had this, and you had that, and just, you know, you lived in your own ghetto, and it was perfectly fine. That's no longer possible. That's no longer possible for one simple reason, that because the internet and social media, especially the internet, because the internet is so necessary for work that we really can't avoid it. And smartphones, yes, in Haredi circles, smartphones are forbidden, smartphones are taboo, but there were plenty of people who have kosher phones, which don't have net access, and also smartphones. They need them for all kinds of things. And despite all of the official pronouncements by the various authorities, rabbinical or rebbeim, whatever the case might be, More and more people of Haredi orientation, and even more sort of right-wing modern Orthodox, if you wish, You can't keep the net out. You really can't keep it out. So therefore, the outside world comes, like a tsunami into your life. And if you don't have the tools to be able to deal with the challenges and the faux authoritativeness with which many, many people speak. I mean, yeah, it's a little crazy. I mean, there's a famous cartoon that my wife likes to put up on the fridge some periodically that has a guy bent over his computer screen, and the wife says, "Come to bed already." And he says, "No, no, 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 no. There's somebody I have to, one more thing I have to, somebody wrong on the internet." It's very, open-ended. It's the Wild West there, but it is true that you're exposed to more and more things. You can't hide. So the option of pristine faith is less and less an option. So therefore, the question of what do you do with doubt, and how do you address it, and how do you resolve it, and can you live with it, and so on and so forth. These questions are not just for people who live in the outside world most of the time, but also for those who have been trying to hide from it. I mentioned Allison in her program, Hamakom, because she has a wonderful effort to try to help people from Haredi backgrounds who have not been able to deal with this tsunami of the outside world that's coming at them critically and possibly, and help them to try to stay within Judaism and not just chuck it all. Because there are many wonderful things about the internet. There are many, many deleterious things about the internet, and one of them is that, one of the bad things is that everything's binary. It's either or, and many, many people who write on the net, as convincing or as authoritatively as they write, are often incredibly superficial and incredibly silly. I don't mean to make fun. Well, this person I do make fun. Having read things by Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and all these guys, and I sit there and read their attacks on God and attacks on religion, I'm like, this is stupid. I mean, they ask simple questions and they simplistic questions and they give like even more simplistic answers and you get nothing. I mean, it's really incredible. I can't. They're supposed to be intelligent people. Don't you have any sophistication of thought at all? In any case, but let's put that aside for a second. In any event, so her program Hamakom, I meant to say, is aimed at that, and I really applaud her efforts. Okay, this was an unsolicited commercial for Allison Joseph's activities. In any event, today I think that this option of choosing between the two types of belief is not possible because the world comes at you. So therefore, the question does arise. Okay, so now we're engaging the world. Doubt is not something you can run away from. In other words, that injunction of the Mishnah no longer is really not practicable. So therefore, Aseh Lecha Rav Istalek Ben HaSafek is not just a matter of being, sort of quietly saying whatever the Rav says, that's fine, but rather you need a teacher to help you to address doubt and what to do with doubt, which in turn raises a different issue. And that is an issue that Maimonides already was very much aware, which is the one I would like to close with today. This, we have a lot more to say about this. In an essay that was republished, oh boy, how many years ago? I don't even know. About 24 years ago, I think it was. Professors David Berger and Lawrence Kaplan in the Torah Mounted Journal began to discuss the question of, okay, if I'm confronting issues that bother me, I'm afraid to open that up. I don't know where it's going to take me. I don't know what it's going to take. They are responding. They wrote this essay called, I'll tell you what the essay is officially called. It's online at YU Torah, by the way, for anybody who wants. Oh, it's called On Freedom of Inquiry and the Rambam Antidote. So they're responding to a Rosh Hashiva who had said you should never think anything which is not 100% frum, and which if you do so, then you're out and goodbye. And they said that they don't think that that's Maimonides' position. and that there's another way to go about this, that it's not asking questions per se is not a bad thing. Having doubts per se is not a bad thing, and that's the line that's basically the line that Rabbi Lam Zatzal also posits in the essay that I promised I would link to. So the two of them write as follows. This is on page 38 of the essay. Our quest for a clear understanding of the scope of this prohibition. There is a prohibition to entertain heretical ideas. Okay. So in other words, what we're talking about is there are ideas that are outside of the realm of Judaism. For example, you're not allowed to believe that a Jew is not allowed to believe that God is three, or that he can become a human being. God wouldn't become a human being. In fact, the definition of false worship, of foreign worship, of avodah zarah, is in fact, and this is Professor David Berger's definition, which I think is wonderful, is to attribute divinity or to worship as God someone or something which is not, in fact, God. Which includes, as a subcategory, idols. But you can have avodah zarah without, without idols. See, as long as, if you worship a human being, then that's avodah zarah. In other words, Christianity's problem is not the Trinity, per se. It's attributing divinity to a human being whose name was Joshua Bar Joseph. In any case, so he writes as follows. Our quest for a clearer understanding of the scope of this prohibition can be facilitated by examining the Rambam's narrow formulation in Sefer Mitzvot, the Sefer Mitzvot negative 47. We have been commanded not to exercise freedom of thought to the point of holding views opposed to those expressed in the Torah. Rather, we must limit our thought by setting up a boundary where it must stop. And that boundary is the commandments and injunctions of the Torah. Okay? So what does he mean? So they explain. Here the Rambam defines the biblical prohibition in terms of accepting heretical doctrine rather than entertaining thoughts about with the potential of leading to such doctrine. It is no doubt true that if a person feels that the pursuit of a particular argument is seriously threatening his or her belief in what is clearly a cardinal principle of Judaism, there exists an obligation to take the intellectual equivalent of a cold shower, and the ruling of the Mishnah Torah underscores the obligation. In other words, what one is obligated to do is to say, I recognize that some thoughts are wrong. I will accept that in advance. That's part of my Kabbalat Olmo Chut Shamayim. However, I'm allowed to explore different ideas and keep an open mind. The minute I see I'm going off of the wrong thing, I have to defer. In other words, the doubt is a legitimate religious category. But it's trumped, and this is a word I can come back and use now, it's trumped effectively by belief. In other words, belief, conviction is higher. One's a priori convictions are higher than, are more important. And the collective belief system of the world in which I live, I must defer, but I'm allowed to explore, I'm encouraged, according to Maimonides, to explore the parameters of Jewish belief, the nuances of Jewish belief, which may not be agreed upon by everybody. I'm expected to have the intellectual humility, which is not something which is very common. It's like common sense, it's not very common. So intellectual humility, intellectual arrogance, on the contrary, is the original sin of our generation, of our society. To have the intellectual humility to say, I'll live with it. I wonder. I don't think I can know everything. I certainly will not deduce, or I will not conclude half-baked conclusions from a question or a lack of clarity on any one issue. So is Talek Ma'asafek, so that kind of doubt should not be the type of doubt that will gnaw at you and will eat away at you because it's something you're working on out of faith that it's resolvable. And if it's not resolvable, if one recognizes that in fact one is not capable of resolving it. So one said, you know what, I can live with it. I know that there are bigger minds, greater minds than I. There are greater ideas than I, and I can't. There are things that are beyond my capacity. Now, that sounds like a cop-out, but the truth of the matter is that we are limited. That we are limited, and if we learned anything in the world of Corona, is we learned our limitations. That, indeed, is the conclusion which is provided by the book of Job. After so many, I mean, it's perfectly legitimate to deal with the question of why the righteous suffer. The question of the Shoah is in fact a something which we just sit there and are stunned by its monstrosity. And the question of God in the Shoah and man in the Shoah, these are questions that are truly beyond. They're very, very, in Hebrew you say "endolot aleinu." They're just incredibly overwhelming. And the answer that Job gets in the book, which is the sacred book, which is devoted to the question of theodicy, of divine judgment, is that there are some things you just can't understand. And you have to stand there and realize your own limitations. I mean, we can't imagine infinity. We can't imagine perfection. We can't, if you really think about what it means to travel a light year, I wish you luck. I can't. I can't imagine that kind of distances. So if that's the case, never mind something as unfathomable as questions of divine judgment, never mind the Shoah. So that this is it's a very interesting balance. This Dalek Ma'asafek would then mean that try to avoid doubt, but you can't get away from it, and you have to learn to live with it. Now, that has a lot of implications. In a world, in our society, where we want instant gratification, and we want to know the answer now, or we want it today, yesterday, and it should be actually accessible and understandable immediately, that's a very unsatisfying answer. However, it might be the most realistic one. It is certainly true that intellectual humility, if you wish, the answer that God gave to Moses according to the first school, that you can come as close as possible, but you got to understand there are places you can't go, is a major. If I had to add one of the 13 principles of faith, I would actually add that. I believe with a full faith that man is limited and man should maximize who he is, but there are places he's just not going to be able to get there. And a little bit more humility, I think, would in fact go a very long way in terms of making our world a better place. Okay, we will continue this Mirtz Hashem next week because there's a lot more to say. And we will end up getting off this Mishnah eventually, I promise. In the meantime, I don't know who's not vaccinated yet, but if you haven't, if you're Israeli, there are a million Israelis who have not yet been vaccinated. If you haven't gotten vaccinated, go get vaccinated. Then we can have herd immunity, and then we can get rid of the masks or whatever they're dangling in front of our faces. Those of you who were abroad, I hope that they make them available as soon as possible, and that we can start putting this behind us. In any case, have a wonderful week. I will be posting on my Facebook page my weekly 10 minutes on the Parsha. Probably then to get it done on Thursday. You're invited to check it out. You're invited to share this and any other video of mine or of the Tel Aviv International Synagogue headed by the inimitable Rabbi Ariel Constantine. And be well. We'll see you. Bye.